I'd like to begin this evening talk with a tiny confession. Years ago, times that I used to live off Israel, traveling, trying new places, I discovered a new country, a new continent, Australia. I fell in love with it, and I was there for quite a long while. Things changed, and I had to leave and come back to Israel. I think it was a couple of days after my return, there was a Kabbalat Shabbat, like we had yesterday, in Friend's place in Adar Yosef. And I was so excited about Australia and so passionate about it, telling stories to all my friends. And after a while, one of my friends said, "Hey, Jama, let's go, let's move to Australia." And one of my friends gave her a gaze, like, look at her, and said, "You go to speak English." And for me, I remember so much that, because at times come, I started to realize, like, my deep love for Hebrew, my deep connection, my attachment for Hebrew. So every time it's my role to talk here from the stage, I try to check with Shaila. "Shaila, aren't you tired? Don't you want to have a nap?" But Shaila is a very committed Dharma person. And she wouldn't miss a Dharma word. And she's also a very supportive senior teacher. And she's here. And I'm talking happily English. Many of us here know the teachings called the Four Noble Truths, or the Four Ennobling Truths, which are kind of pillar of the Buddhist teachings. Teachings which you can find at the very center, if we can say center, about Dharma teachings, in all the different tradition and all different interpretation of the Dharma. The Four Noble Truths are the truth of suffering, anguish, insatisfactoriness, sevel, inachat. This is the first one. The second noble truth is the truth regarding the origin of suffering, the cause of suffering, namely grasping, attachment, desire. The third truth is the truth regarding the end of suffering. And the fourth truth is the truth of the path, the way in the direction of ending suffering. Stephen Batchelor, a Dharma teacher, British originally, that lives in France, that used to be a monk for many years, and wrote some a few very interesting books regarding the Dharma. In one of his books, he's mentioning a passage from Alice in Wonderland. Passage where Alice is going into a room, and in the room there is a bottle. And on the bottle there is a tavit, label. And this label doesn't say beer or coke or juice. It says, "Drink me." And he brings this passage in order to emphasize the fact that the Four Noble Truths are not truth, definitely not some things to believe in or just facts to know. They are facts that call us for relationship, for action towards them. The first and the third, the truth regarding suffering and the truth regarding end of suffering, have the label of understand me, realize me on them, in relation to them. The fourth truth, the truth regarding the way, the path, has the label of cultivate me, walk me. The second one, the truth regarding suffering, insatisfactoriness, clinging, the desire that things will be as we desire, has the label let go. Let go of me. There is a passage, short passage I want to read. I'm incredibly sad, said John, his brown eyes full with tears. It seemed to me she had been so happy with her life with me. We were dreaming about having a family together. We were planning living in the forests of the Blue Mountains. That very day, we were actually making our way to the train that would take us from our hometown to a new life altogether. When she suddenly stopped and said she wants to break up. Just like that, completely out of the blue. She didn't even look angry, troubled, or anything while saying, please go. I don't want to see ever again. Then she turned away. I haven't seen her since. John paused for a moment, swallowing a big chunk that has been stuck in the middle of his throat. He then stared quietly, his gaze deep and empty, at the vast blue ocean in front of us. You know, he said eventually, still staring at the ocean, this sadness that fills my heart where I was does not feel like anything I could imagine myself feeling in such circumstances. It feels like a sticky, sad liquid fills not only my heart, but each and every cell of my body. But you know something? Its taste, this taste of sadness, is the only taste that it has. No bitter sorrow, no hot anger, only sadness. Just sadness as such. Period. It sounds, I said, feeling a bit lighter, it sounds like you letting go of her. We were looking at each other, eyeball to eyeball. John smiled. I'm doing nothing, he said. She had gone, that's a fact. I'm just letting that fact be. I guess this passage requires more confessions. The first one is that I wrote it. And the second is that there is no John. It's something that I wrote that was from my time in Australia, actually. Me and my partner, she was Australian, and we planned to live together in Australia. She decided to break up the relationship. That was the reason why I had to leave Australia and come back and go to Adar Yosef, to the Kabbalat Shabbat. Never mind. And it happened to happen, all this story, about a couple of months after the first time I attended a Vipassana retreat there in Australia. I must say, this retreat was hell, really. I went there just to get rid of all my friends that told me to go. It was very clear to me that it's nonsense. It's for all these kind of spiritual people. And there's nothing about it. Yet, I said, eventually, after so many things and so many thoughts, it was then 10 days. I will go for 10 days and I will get rid of this notion for the rest of my life. A lot of pain and the feeling that I cannot meditate, and I didn't trust the teacher, and I felt all the time when he was talking that it's not really important that the experience of you feel meditation. I felt, he's just trying to block me then to see it and to feel it. I'm looking for that, for this ecstasy. I think there was one day, I don't really remember which, that I felt that I've got it, and all this day I was like walking like here. And then the next day it's gone, and all this pain and anger and rage, I wanted to kill somebody, really. And that's the way it ends. It didn't change till the end. And then the last very day, when I saw all the people talking, and so many of them say, oh, wow, I wanted to kill them. Really. What I'm doing here. I guess the first thing that brought me a bit astonished about all of it, I used to smoke cigarettes at that time. And in my way, I had the thought, should I buy cigarettes or should I not? Tobacco, I used to smoke tobacco. And I said, I'll bet or not, it will. In this place, you were mustn't smoking cigarettes. I mean, if they catch you smoking, those of you that smoke here know that it can happen. There, no way. I decided not to buy any tobacco. At the last day, the retreat ended, and we traveled to a national park, a beautiful place in the forest, just above the ocean. And after 3 days or so, came a few other friends of us. And while we were sitting by night around the fire, one of them took off tobacco. And I realized I forgot about it. And then I didn't want to quit smoking. No way. I'm a smoker. So I told her, hey, Jen, please give me the tobacco. And she gave it to me. And while rolling, it felt different. I don't know, different. I lit a cigarette and I couldn't smoke. It felt just terrible. Not that it will be a promise for anyone here, I mean, but that was my experience, and that was the first thing that I remember that started to bring question in my mind regarding all of these Vipassana teachings. The most important one, or more important one, was a couple of months later in this story, when suddenly I realized that all my relation to this irritating thing, let go, people tell me let go, and always say, what do you want? Somehow I felt I more sense, what does it mean, letting go? I want you to watch this for a moment. Would you see the movement of letting go? Is letting go is a really an action? Is it something that I do? I feel it is very important trying to make it clear that letting go does not mean that things will go. Things that we actually want them to go will go. It does not apply that things will just disappear to this emptiness that Shaila sometimes talks about. It seems like. There is no need to deny things, avoid them, push them away. Ram Dass, an American spiritual teacher, man that used to be a professor in Harvard, lecturing about psychiatry with Timothy Leary in the Happy 60s, went with him through the whole LSD scene and experiments with LSD, afterwards went to India. It's a long story, very interesting one, but anyway, in one of his talks, Ram Dass gave confession about his neurosis, saying that, you know, reflecting about more than 30 years of practice and reflecting about my neurosis, which I'm quite familiar with, I really don't think that even one of my neurosis went away, disappeared. It's just that now they a lot of times make me laugh. Yvonne Weyer, a teacher that was here actually exactly a year ago, in India, once told about an interview she had with a student. While the interview is going on, and in India, there are a lot of mosquitoes and students. Suddenly, during the interview, he told her, you know, it's really astonishing, amazing, that you're not bothered by the mosquitoes. And Yvonne replied him, of course I'm bothered by the mosquitoes. I just don't bother that I'm bothered. I think that in almost any talk here there was little passage or reminder of Nisargadatta Maharaj, an Indian master of last century that wrote I Am Death. And I would like also to read a very short passage that I really like. Between the banks of pain and pleasure, the river of life flows. It is only when the mind refuses to flow with life and gets stuck at the banks that it becomes a problem. By flowing with life, I mean acceptance. Letting come what comes, letting go what goes. I'd like to read it again. Between the banks of pain and pleasure, the river of life flows. It is only when the mind refuses to flow with life and get stuck at the banks that it becomes a problem. By flowing with life, I mean acceptance. Letting come what comes, and letting go what goes. And with this also comes the notion, letting be what is. And many times, this notion, and maybe mostly the last one, letting be what is, bring kind of resistance, because it seems like it applies that change is not acceptable, that action for change is not acceptable. But it doesn't apply it. It doesn't apply for no change, for no action. Actually, healthy action springs from acceptance. Now, some of us don't feel really okay with the presence of our dog when it is in the dining hall, for example, or in the kitchen. I'm very touched to see sometimes when people who feel like that, the way they act, they try to tempt him to go out, maybe even push him gently. This is an action that I feel that is coming from acceptance. If there was no acceptance, they would just kick him. But letting go, letting be, does not apply that there is no room for change, that there is no room for action. When come about it, the big question, so how would I know? There is a piece that I really like, that just Shaila let me know yesterday, that it's taken from a Christian prayer. It says, God, please give me the courage to change what needs to be changed and can be changed. Please give me the patience to live without that cannot be changed. And please give me the serenity, the wisdom, to know the difference. Very important notion to introduce while talking about letting go is the notion of anicca. Impermanence. Life is a flux. Things constantly change. Sensations, sounds, thoughts, feelings keep changing. Anything you could sense, smell, taste, listen, see, is bound to change. Whatever you could perceive, could think about, could feel, is bound to change. It may be your relationship. It may be this retreat. It may be your home. It may be your life. Everything that has a beginning will have an end. And it is so important, so useful, understanding that the fact of life is to change. It's because in the very clinging, the very attachment, there is the assumptions, the hidden assumption that things will change, will stay the way they are. There is a story about Chinese old farmer who used to live alone with his son in their farm. One day, his horse ran away. All his neighbors came to see him, telling him they are so sorry for him and such a bad luck. And this man told them, bad luck, good luck, who knows? After a couple of days, the horse came back. But he didn't come back alone. It brought from him from the wild another horse. All his neighbors came to him this evening and told him, oh, we come to greet you. You have such a good luck. And he told them, good luck, bad luck, who knows? A week later, his son was riding the horse and the horse threw him. And he broke his leg. All his neighbors came, told him, oh, we're so sorry for you, such bad luck. And he told them, bad luck, good luck, who knows? A couple of days later, the army was knocking at his door. There was a war and they wanted to come and take all the young men. They wanted his son to come, to be a soldier, to fight. Told them, look at him. So they let him go. What he will do with a guy with a broken leg? Well, his neighbors came this evening to greet him. Oh, so great, you're so lucky, such a good luck. So then, when will you understand? Good luck, bad luck, who knows? All our perceptions of good or bad are accordance to conditions, and conditions are bound to change. There is nothing about conditions that we can trust. Trust hoping for lasting happiness. Sometimes in life, a lot in these retreats, a lot in this part of the retreat, come the question, where does it all lead? All this practice, all these teachings, where does it lead to? Frankly, truly, I don't know. Christopher, a teacher known by many of us, is actually a teacher of all three of us. Once was asked about with someone who I guess was kind of struggling with all of this notion of trying to be here and now. Think, Christopher, what is so special about this here and now? And Christopher told him, there is nothing special about here and now. So, yeah, but you guys talk a lot about being here and now, being here and now. What is so special about being here and now? Christopher replied, there's nothing really special about being here and now. Nothing really significant about it. What is significant, he said, what is significant is what is revealed through being here and now. What is it that revealed? When we're here and now. In my way here, in the car of Nitzan and Ram, who gave me a ride, sitting back with all these bags, you know, coming to the retreat, there are a lot of bags. It was me and the bags. I think I was Nanti, and and suddenly a story of my mommy came to me, a story that I really like. She's telling, she, like many other stories, she likes to tell me again and again, and I always enjoy actually. And I remember I had the thought, I will tell it in the retreat. So it happened many, many years ago, in the early or mid 60s actually. All her friends started to buy washing machines, and they didn't have yet, and she didn't even dare to talk with my father about it. She knew that we, I mean, I wasn't really present at that time. We really don't have lots of money, and she knew that my father is kind of conservative way of thinking. Eventually, after she really felt she wanted, she came to him and told him, "Oh, Dad, you know, I really feel that a washing machine will help me. So much of my life is with this, you know, pile outside on the hot water making all of this laundry, and also your mother, they live together, and all of the friends got one, and I really want to have a washing machine." And he told her, "Chayale, if you feel like that, okay. Let's buy a washing machine. Go and choose one." So she took the bus to Tel Aviv and went to the Shechem. It's a big department store in Israel. And there she saw that among the machines there is also a new machine, automatic washing machine. I guess many of you guys don't know what does it mean, but the first washing machines, it was not going automatic from one phase to another. You press the button and it made the first stage, and then you have to come and press the button and it did the first. And then she saw, the first time that she saw automatic washing machine, and she fancied that, and she came to my dad and told him, "I want an automatic washing machine." So he asked her, "What do you need automatic washing machine for?" And then she told him, "I could press the button and go." So he told her, "Chayale, where would you go to?"
Thank you.
Where would you go to? I want to end with a with a short passage of It is an American writer named Raymond Carver. Was writing mostly short stories. There was a movie called Shortcut of Robert Altman that was based on his stories, also poems. He's nothing like a spiritual teacher or spiritual writer. He actually had quite a difficult life. He was alcoholic, came from alcoholic family. He actually died in his 50s from his liver because of the alcohol. Something about his writing, the depth, the clear seeing of things, the crystal clear description of life, I find it really, really touching and really deep. And there is just the one passage that I want to read from him, which not necessarily connect to what all these things I said. But for me connect a lot to the sense of what I'm doing here, practicing. And although he's American, I've got this passage in Hebrew. קורה שאדם נולד לתוך ארץ זרה, שלמרות שיש לו אב ואם, אחים ואחיות, שפה ותרבות, הוא בעצם ממקום אחר, והוא לא יודע את זה. הוא כואב כל חייו, עד שהוא מבין, ומתחיל חזרה את המסע אל ארץ מולדתו, שמעולם לא היה בה, ואף אחד לא יכול להבטיח לו, שהיא אכן קיימת. אדם כזה נולד לתוך גיהנום, ובהתחלה הוא אינו יודע שזה הגיהנום. הוא ממשיך לחיות את חייו וליפול שוב ושוב, ורק אחרי זמן ארוך משהו קורה. זה רגע של חסד, שבו הוא זוכה לראות, ולו לרגע מהיר ובהיר אחד, את המקום שלו. פיסת גלויה קרועה מן המקום שלו, נאמר, או מישהו משם שחולף על פניו ומחייך. רגע שמשנה את חייו, משום שבבת אחת הוא מבין שאכן יש מקום כזה, שהוא לא חולם, שיש חיים טובים מאלה שהוא חי עכשיו. וגם כמובן, באותו הרגע, הוא גם מבין שהוא חי בגיהנום. Let's sit for a couple of moments.